Good evening, everyone. This is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is a special edition of GS Radio. And tonight we're going to be talking again about elder abuse, and we'll get to that just shortly. I want to apologize, everyone, for Sunday evening. As many of you know, computer systems, net, ISP providers went down in various parts of the country, and I was one of those locations. Many people lost service, lost internet altogether, or had no domain name servers, which it was my case. Had absolutely nothing, and that was that way for more than 12 hours. So I want to apologize to everybody that tried to log in and listen to the show. It was a no-go. Or even our friends at Red State Radio were offline for 6 hours. And we are an affiliate of Red State Radio now, and it has done a tremendous amount to contributing to our listenership. We have many new listeners. I want to welcome all of you. As always, you can call in at 917-388-4520 to ask questions, to make comments. And, of course, I will not tolerate any kind of name-calling or attacking. None of that. Don't even try that with me. But this evening, we're going to be talking about Gisella Riordan again. And with me is Linda Kincaid, who has been following this case very closely, attempting to get visits with Gisella, who has been isolated for some time now. And Linda, I want to welcome you to the show and thank you for all the work you've done putting these shows together. And I have to give her credit for that. It's Linda who has lined this up and set it up so that it makes some kind of order. We can follow these cases along. So Linda, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you in hosting for this, Marty.
No, you bet. You did have one little good piece of news as a result of calling in on a radio show there locally. You want to tell everybody about that?
Well, we will hope it turns into something positive. San Jose Mayor Chuck Reed was on a live radio town hall meeting last night, and I called up, got in the queue, got connected to Mayor Reed, gave him a very brief summary of Gisella's case, and he said if I would forward the information to him, he would send it on to the police chief, and I sent it to him this morning at his city hall email address, and I got an email back that it was going on to the police chief. So we'll see where it goes from there.
Excellent. I'm hoping that with these broadcasts, if we can keep the spotlight on this case in particular for right now, that hopefully we can effect a change for her. What you said that you had seen her, I believe it was in April.
I saw her on four consecutive evenings at the end of April and the 1st of May.
Okay. And what was her condition at that time, Linda?
She was quite thin, but I would say reasonably healthy. I was concerned that she's not getting enough to eat. Her dentures were missing. I don't know if those have been recovered or not. So she had some difficulty eating. I have photos of her from earlier that her son gave to me where she looked healthy. How would I describe her? Well-fleshed. I mean, not fat, but in a healthy, stocky kind of way. She's a German lady, and she was a buxom, very attractive woman. And she's now, my mom is about 100 pounds, and I would say Gisella was probably about the same. Her arms were so thin, and her face was very thin, and her cheeks sunken. So I really am concerned that she is not eating enough.
I don't. Again, you've reported this particular case, along with many other things, to basically every agency you could think of with no results. And recently you had written to this Lightborn fellow who had responded that supposedly this facility that this woman is in has their own rules that don't necessarily jive with state law and regulation regarding the elderly and not isolating them, that, you know, you're prohibited from isolating them. And can you just kind of explain again what the excuses are they're giving for why they have isolated this woman?
There are two sets of excuses that go with two sets of regulations. And the one that Will Lightborn was addressing was the fact that Giselle is a conservatee of the Public Guardian. Now, that does not mean that she loses all rights, and we've gone over California laws before, and we can address those again if we want to tonight. Giselle still has rights. Just because someone becomes a conservatee, they do not lose rights. They do not get locked up. You know, they do not go into solitary confinement in prison. It just means that someone else is appointed to care for some of their affairs for them because, for whatever reason, they're not able to manage that, as a lot of people, as they get older, do need a bit of assistance. But what has happened in Giselle's case, and probably quite a number of other cases across the country, certainly other cases in Santa Clara County, the Public Guardian is going far beyond their legal authority in managing their conservatees. Rather than coming in and paying their bills, making sure they have health care, making sure they have their daily needs met, instead the Public Guardian is taking control of everything, locking the person up, and not letting them have access to things that they might want, might need, and not letting them have access to their families or friends.
The thing I don't understand, Linda, is why the isolation. Okay, you're using these kangaroo courts and twisting the laws, and you're looting these people's estates, or you're making a fortune defrauding Medicare, Medicaid, whatever it is you're doing. And apparently, the way things look right now, nobody can stop these predators from doing this. So as long as they can't be stopped and the courts back them up, I see this isolation as just vindictiveness. I just see it as maliciousness. Because what possible reason could they have? They've got all the control as it is. What difference would it make if this person had visitors? That's what I don't understand. Why is it so necessary to cut them off from everyone?
I've wrestled with that question myself. As you know, I've been through a similar situation with my own mother. My mom was abducted, imprisoned, and isolated just like Giselle, which is how I got interested in this issue and came to be an elder advocate. I had no idea these sorts of things went on until it happened to my own mother. And I have asked that very same question. The person who took control of my mother's affairs got control of the money, and they already had her estate. Why did they also need to be so needlessly mean, cruel, vindictive to lock her up and not let her see people that she was begging to see? And I can only come up with two things. One of them is it's a control trip. These are sociopathic people who thrive on hurting others, and that's my personal opinion. We might be able to get some more discussion on that next Sunday when we have Dr. Bob on the show. But the other thing is that if you read literature on elders and people who are isolated, they die more quickly. They waste away. You know, in the time that my mother, the 15 months that my mother was isolated, she just wasted away. She lost the ability to walk. She lost a lot of her memories. She already had dementia, but it progressed much more rapidly, we believe, as a result of her being isolated. In Giselle's case, in a lot of ways, it was a lot more painful to go see Giselle and know that she's isolated because she does not have dementia like my mother does. You know, whether my mom has visitors every day or not, she probably doesn't really understand or remember the next day. I think it's good to visit her and try to cheer her up and bring her nice things to make her happy at the moment. I doubt that it really makes much of a long-term difference to her at her stage of advanced Alzheimer's. But Giselle is not in that situation. You know, I mean, I know what dementia looks like. I see it when I visit my mother. And Giselle is, when she's happy, she's bright, she's alert, she's communicative, she initiates conversations. The four evenings when I got in to see her before the facility realized that I was not with the Public Guardian, she became very talkative about all sorts of things. One evening when I was leaving, she asked when I was coming back, and I said I would be back at 6 o'clock the next evening. And I didn't get over there until about 6:30, and she chewed me out for being half an hour late. So this woman is oriented to time, place, person,
yes,
people around her. She knows what's going on, and she is being harmed emotionally, mentally by it every day. There's no way this is not elder abuse.
Well, and Linda, the thing is, too, when you look at what our own government does with prisoners, they consider it okay and a form of torture to isolate people. And particularly where it may not be relatives in the case of political prisoners, to isolate them from people of their same community, other people, let's take Gitmo, for instance. They're all coming from Afghanistan, or they're coming from Iraq, or wherever they've picked these people up and kidnapped them from. But they isolate them one from the other so that they are, while they may see a guard similar to a nurse, or they may see, you know, other security personnel, such as people who come in and clean the rooms, change the beds and things. This is torture. This is a recognized form of torture.
I agree completely.
And this is what they're doing to these people who are absolutely defenseless against them.
Now, they've done nothing wrong. These are not war criminals. These are not even petty criminals who've done something that society considers inappropriate. These are people who have... Their failing is that they grew old and had assets to their names, and that made them targets.
Exactly. It has become a crime to get old with assets. I know that one of the things that happens here when you go into the hospital here in my area, the first thing they do is an asset search on you. And when I asked why that was done, they said, well, we want to make sure you can pay the bill. I said, well, I just handed you an insurance card. Well, yeah, but the billing might exceed. And I was looking at this woman. I said, what you mean is, if I got $1 million in the bank, you're going to call APS. And then you're probably going to call someone you know who works as a predatory guardian, makes their living that way. And she got up and just ran away.
I think you nailed it.
Yeah, and I found out through a friend of mine who actually works in admissions at a large hospital down in the Twin Cities that this is exactly what they do. When you're checking in, they immediately run an asset search. So these people are targeted when they come in. And another way that they find these people, and we've had this, it's just prolific here in this area, I'm assuming it's the same way across the country. We have these attorneys getting together and advertising, you know, come to our dinner and our meeting and learn how to avoid conservatorship and protect your assets. All they're doing is databasing. Before you can even get into the meeting, you have to fill out a form telling what your assets are, where they're located, what they're worth, any legal instruments you've got, a will, a trust, whatever it is, a medical directive. They've got all your information. You come into the system and you're flagged. Don't give these people any information. Don't tell anybody what you may or may not have or own. And because there's somebody out there looking to take it from you, and if they have to kill you to do it, they will. I was really impressed with the letter that you sent back to the mayor. Quite impressed with it.
Thank you.
One of the things that bothers me here, you talk about law enforcement in your mother's case. And you said, and this is just in your notation, that the Wildwood Canyon Villa has instructed their staff to call the police and report any further actions by Linda Kincaid and her associates as criminal acts. So attempting to see your mother is a criminal act.
Yes, that is what I got from a Sergeant Paul Morrison of the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department. And that was in response to my filing complaints that my mother was being isolated and not allowed to have visitors.
And then it says, Linda Kincaid and her associates are considered trespassing if they are located anywhere on the property of the facility.
And that is a standard tactic, yes.
Well, what that indicates to me is, yes, we are holding, in this case, your mother prisoner, And if you come anywhere around here, you're in trouble. And then it says any further telephone calls may be considered as annoying and threatening.
I still wonder how a telephone call can be threatening.
Yeah. This is just absolutely, I just cannot believe that these people are getting away with this, Linda. They're doing it right out in the open. They're doing it right out in front of God and everybody. And yet this constant, I mean, when I look at the list of agencies you've gone to, people you've talked to, reports you've filed, and nobody can do anything. Nobody can do anything. This is just, I don't know. And what did you tell me you had spent so far just trying to get visitation with your mother?
Well, for visitation, it cost us $70,000. We are far beyond that now. We are actually attempting to overturn the bogus documents. We're trying to recover my mother's estate, and we're also trying to bring elder abuse litigation against the people who did this. But just to get visitation, just to be able to go in that door and see my mother, cost $70,000. And
oh
it took
God.
Over a year to accomplish that.
Oh, and you go on and say here, when it comes to adult protective services, and I'll tell you, most of the people I know who are elderly, I refuse to include myself in that category, but they're older than me. But the older people, if you mention adult protective services to them, they just recoil. Something I found out, Linda, when I was skulking around and looking for things, that in 2009, as a result of everybody hammering Herb Kohl's useless committee, they passed the Elder Justice Act in 2009, which basically just turned out to be an expansion of power for adult protective services across the country and grants totaling $11.5 million. For an agency that has become an active threat to elderly people in this country. And I'm not saying that there are not times that they have rescued maybe someone who's homeless or someone who did need help. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is too many times what they are doing is representing a real and present danger and threat to elderly people who have assets. And it seems they're more than willing. I found out also they're on a quota system. They have to put so many people a month, like into homes, or they have to show activity, let me put it that way, go ahead.
But you do not find adult protective services at homeless camps or down in the park where people are sleeping on park benches and can probably benefit from a few good meals and a bed to sleep in. We don't find APS being concerned about protecting and conserving those individuals who likely do need help. We find APS hanging around hospitals, hanging around emergency rooms, hanging around any place where people with assets might be a bit vulnerable. And APS was not responsible in getting my mother to where she is, but in so many cases I do hear that the initial move for the government to take over came from APS. You know, a call to APS mm-hmm. came from a social worker, a hospital, someone in a doctor's office, and next thing you know, the public guardian is petitioning for conservatorship. The family has lost control of their loved one. Not far down the road, the family is evicted from the home is sold. And I hear these stories over and over and over.
I have one lady here in Minnesota who they literally kicked her door in and took her out of, she lived out here on a farm. Of course, farmland in Minnesota is prime property. She was third generation on that farm. They kicked her door in, hauled her away, sold the farm. Now, when this went to court, she had had, of course, a will stating that the farm was to be left to her two sons and divided equally between them, however they wanted to do it. They took that property and they sold it, and it was worth a small fortune. And the will she had set up was thrown out of court by the judge. And her heirs were deprived of what they should have gotten. And this is the other aspect of this. Families are deprived of things they should have inherited under normal circumstances, even when there are legal instruments in place. These probate judges, and I hate even calling them judges, just throw these documents out and say they're not any good and move on. So setting these things up, and one of the things her attorney had mentioned was that they have even tried, like, transferring the property, and I can't remember what it was called, but it was like on a tentative basis. In the event something would happen, she should die suddenly, you know, any number of things could have happened, that the property would transfer immediately. So when, under the tenets of that, when they snatched her, the family filed immediately, and they did take possession of the property. The judge threw it out. The predatory guardian sold that farm, pocketed the money, and walked away. And this is what happens too many times. It is such a vast transfer of wealth by an organized ring of thieves that use these kangaroo courts to get all this done. One of the things, Elaine, it was wanting to ask you, if you filed for reimbursement for your legal fees from the guardian issue, did you?
No. I may be able to at some point in time. Really nothing has happened in the court we're in so far. There's a new judge coming in next year, and we may or may not have things happening a bit more rapidly. But no, we're more than 2 years out from when my mom was abducted, and we anticipate three trials, and our first trial is scheduled for February of next year. You know, coming up on 3 years after my mom was abducted, that will be our first trial to determine who will be the conservator. There will be another trial on the documents that my mom signed after she already had Alzheimer's, the bogus trust, will, power of attorney, advanced health care. There will be a trial on those issues. And then after my mom dies, there will be a trial on elder abuse. I do not have standing to sue for elder abuse while my mother is still alive. Only her conservator can sue on her behalf for elder abuse. And obviously the conservator is not going to sue herself.
Wait.
Yes, I do not have standing.
That is your mother? That is your mother, your biological mother.
That is my mother. I have no rights. My mother has a conservator. There is a warped logic to it, but it doesn't pass the gut level, how does it smell test. Imagine if someone commits a crime against you. You have standing to sue that person for the harm done to you. Now, if you're old and impaired and you have someone else who's acting on your behalf, then that other person is the one who should sue on your behalf for that injury to you. But when the abuser is the conservator, we now have a case where the person who's responsible for suing is also the person doing the abuse. And it just kind of all falls apart. So where it lands at this point in time, at least in California, is that I have to wait for my mother to die. And once my mother passes, I will then have standing to sue for elder abuse. So that will be our third trial after my mother is dead.
That's disgusting.
Linda, so you can see where my life is going for the next 5 years or so.
Yes. Let me ask you this. What about the possibility of filing a civil suit against the guardian and also bringing criminal charges?
We have filed civil litigation against the conservator and also the facility where my mom was isolated. Criminal charges have to come from the police, and, well, you saw the email from that Sergeant Morrison. The police do not believe that any crime has been committed.
Yeah, well, it wasn't their mother in there, was it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, if it was his mom, he might see things a little bit differently, but until mm-hmm. that happens, he does not consider that any crime has been committed. I've talked to the deputy DA for San Bernardino County, Tristan Savari. He's told me time and again, there is nothing out of the ordinary, and that's a direct quote from Tristan Savari.
That doesn't mean that there isn't anything wrong. It just means that's what we do all the damn time.
Yeah, it just means it's nothing out of the ordinary in San Bernardino County, and I think I believe him.
This is just disgusting, just absolutely disgusting. I don't know how you keep your composure, and you are a very composed person, very articulate. How do you people keep your composure in the face of all this? I couldn't do it. Of course, I'm known for having a short
fuse. I schedule regular breakdowns.
Because I would just be going insane. The frustration, I cannot imagine the frustration. And just as a follow-up to the show we did before, I did call all the supervisors, and I called Mr. Lightborn's office. And when I called Mr. Lightborn's office, his receptionist asked me who I was. And when I told her who I was, she hung up. And
not even a flight, he's not available, just flat out hung up?
No, she just hung up. And so I called back, of course, assuming that we were accidentally disconnected.
Of course.
And I said, geez, I said, I'm sorry, but we accidentally got disconnected. This is Marty Oakley. Click. And I thought, well. And so, but with all of the other supervisors, without exception, they were either in a meeting that they were going to be in all day long, or they were out of the office, expected never to return. And
that might
two
be a good
of
thing.
Them, I suspect, actually did fly off the planet. But absolutely no one would speak to me. And the one office I called, I said to them, I said, I'm a radio show host. We've been doing a series of shows on guardianship abuse, and I would like to extend to you the opportunity to come on the show and maybe help explain away some of the frustration people involved in this are feeling. You know, this is an opportunity. And the lady on the other end of the phone called me kind of a nasty name and hung up. And she was probably right. I probably am one of those, but she doesn't know that. And but so the offer still stands. Anybody involved with Adult Protective Services, anyone that's a supervisor, anybody that's an ombudsman, anybody that runs one of these facilities, you want equal time, we're here. Just give me a buzz. You can call me at 320-281-0585. Just give me a call. I will set up a special show for you. And if you're afraid of people flying through the phone line and attacking you, we can stop all calls so you can say what you have to say. So the offer stands anytime. Any of you want to come on and speak, just give us a buzz. Linda, this stuff just drives me up the wall. You talked about this Sergeant Benitez, I think is how you pronounce it.
Yes, that's in San Jose. He's the one who, well, Carrie Ann Ducrittenden contacted him initially, called for a civil standby for people to visit, asked for a welfare check on Giselle. And what I sent to you in my notes is part of the email that came back from him. He's essentially saying, there's nothing wrong here. And so I followed up with him.
He wasn't saying there's nothing wrong. He was just basically saying, this goes on all the time. What do you want me to do?
That's pretty close to it. I followed up with an email to him, sending him the packet, the information packet I have, the case history on Giselle, asked him to make a time when we could go over the documents, didn't hear back. I followed that with a voicemail. Didn't hear back from him on that either. Then I went to I called the non-emergency line for San Jose Police and just asked, what do I do to report elder abuse? Who should I talk to? He said, well, you can just have a patrol officer come out and take your report. And, well, I've already got it all the way to the level of a sergeant, and he's not talking to me. I think I need to go someplace else. You know, where do you go? Who do you have investigators who specialize in elder abuse? And she told me, go to the family violence unit. I said, well, this is not a case of the family being violent. This is someone outside the family harming an older person. And, well, elder abuse is handled through the family violence unit. So go to the family violence unit. So I call up the family violence unit, talk to a couple of people, and I get to a Sergeant Murphy, who is the director of that unit. And he was very polite, very courteous, listened to the story, and then told me how busy he is and how much he has to do, and he just really doesn't have time.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that Mayor Reed can encourage the police chief to encourage his family violence unit to follow up on at least one elder who is being mistreated.
I have an email here that just came in. And this is from Doug in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And Doug says, you people are all idiots. The GAO has issued a report for years saying it is family members who do this. It is not these predatory guardians you're talking about all the time. A bunch of paranoid freaks. Well, Doug, honey, you can kiss my big fluffy butt. Because if you actually read those GAO reports, you'd realize that only 4-5% of these cases are committed by family members. The rest of them are by people unknown to the family who work and make their living as parasites. So you go back and read those reports again, and then you come back and tell me how we're a bunch of idiots, you jackass. Anyway, the frustration I feel in this stuff is absolutely immeasurable. And the unwillingness of anyone to speak to this honestly, to answer any questions. These people are hired to do a job. They're not doing it.
My tax dollars are paying for what's happening here in Santa Clara County.
Exactly.
You know, I'm paying the salaries of the people who are doing this to Giselle.
Exactly. So why can't you file malfeasance charges against them? When someone, malfeasance is when you use an official office and you're hired in a specific capacity to perform specific things. And these are all offices created on the premise that the person holding them will act to protect these people from all comers. At all times, they are to protect these people. They are obviously not doing that and they are, in fact, working to harm them. And they're facilitating harm to these people. This is malfeasance of office. Why can't we charge under that?
I think it would be fantastic if we could have a class action suit or the type of suit that you're talking about. But as someone who is in litigation, I know how expensive it is, and it is not an option for most of these families. You know, most of the families are bankrupted just from trying to take care of the basics. Well, I mean, they're thrown out of their homes in most cases. So filing a lawsuit sounds great, and if we could find some hot dog young attorney who's out to make a name for him or herself, because this would be high profile and he could make his mark on the world and ride on this for years to come, that would be absolutely fantastic, and I would be thrilled to work with someone like that and provide all of my notes and every bit of support I can. But for an individual or even a few individuals to bring a civil suit is really prohibitive. We're over $200,000 on my mom's lawsuit already, and most of these families are not in a position to do that.
Okay, what about the ACLU? I mean, for crap's sake, they'll
I've called them time and again.
Ah, jeez. Just to give everybody kind of a rundown of what she has done here and how these things go, she says she wrote to Colleen Krieger, director of the County Department of Aging and Adult Services. This was October 2011.
That one's actually funny.
16 months after your mother was abducted. The response was, at this time, your ongoing concerns regarding your mother's care would be better addressed through the pending case in the San Bernardino Superior Court. So you wrote to Joseph Rodriguez, state long-term care ombudsman, complaining about Colleen Krieger denying services in a letter dated June 27th of 2012. The response was, if you are dissatisfied with the outcome thus far, you may submit your complaint in writing to the Director of the Department of Aging and Adult Services. The letter provides contact information for Colleen Krieger, the person you originally complained about in your letter to the state long-term care ombudsman. This is just this round and round and round, and they just pass everybody back and forth, and nobody does squat.
Yeah, nobody. If this were on TV, it would be funny. When it's my mother's life, it's not so funny.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, he refers me back to the very person that I was complaining about.
Okay, here's another suggestion, and I'm just throwing things out here, Linda. You've probably either already tried them or maybe not. But this police chief, if he contacts you, why don't you take him and go visit Gisela?
Oh, we're going to be in touch with each other, believe me. Carrie Andre was nice enough to find his direct email and forward that to me, and I don't know if he will talk to me, but I will certainly be sending information to him as we go forward from here.
Well, see, that's what I would do. I would or invite this stinking ombudsman and have him go, or get one of these stupid supervisors that sit on their butts and don't do anything. Just tell them, just go with me to the facility. Don't say who you are. Don't call and warn them ahead of time. And let's go.
It'd be nice if they would get off their ends and do that.
It means they'd have to get up out from behind their desk. This is just, and you're absolutely right. These people, as taxpayers, you're forced to pay their salaries. You're forced to pay them for sitting there and doing nothing. I don't know how I'd probably be a serial killer by now. And you talk about Gisela's case here. You said about 10 calls since May 1st, 2012, and you finally got a call back yesterday, August 13th. You say Santa Clara County Ombudsman Wanda Hale told me that she talked to the public guardian. Oh, yippee! And he said Gisela is allowed visitors. Ms. Hale said I would be allowed to visit if I contacted the public guardian. So how did that come out?
I did get to Bruce Thurman, who is the deputy public guardian currently assigned to Giselle's case. And let's see, what were his exact words? There was a long pause followed by negative, that would be a no.
That would be a no, huh?
Yes.
So after saying she could have visitors, apparently you're the only visitor she can't have?
Well, no one else has been able to get through to her either. At one point, I was told that I was not allowed to visit because I had created a disturbance at the facility and I was a danger and a threat to her, and therefore I was not allowed to see her. So some folks they're still a tad undercover. Let's just say some other advocates who will disclose themselves in a few weeks, most likely. Some other advocates coordinated a number of phone calls. I believe we had 18 phone calls over 2 weeks to the facility, and everyone reported back to me what time they called, who they spoke to, and what the response was. And all 18 of those phone calls were told, no, you can't talk to her, you can't see her, except for one phone call where the person on the phone responded with the F word. And I did put that in my letter that I've forwarded on to people because I believe in using direct quotations. But there certainly was nothing positive, nothing that indicated we could work together to resolve the issue.
Do you record your phone calls?
That's problematic in California. Someone calling from outside of the state, depending on your state laws, might be able to do that. In California, you have to have knowledge and consent of both parties. So calling from California, I cannot record phone calls without the consent of the other party, which they obviously are not going to get. Now, I understand there are other states. I think New York might be one of them, where only
and
one person...
And Minnesota's another.
Well, as long as the
yes.
call originates from Minnesota, then Minnesota state laws would apply.
Yes, they would.
And I will just let you do whatever you like with that information.
Thank you, because in Minnesota... you can record a conversation. The law says that as long as one person is aware the conversation is being recorded, even if that person is the person doing the recording.
I would assume you know you're recording.
Yeah, I just think I would.
That works for me just fine.
Yeah.
You know, given I'm in California, I have to follow California laws, but I certainly would encourage people to abide by the laws of their states. And you might be able to get some very interesting recordings that way. So we talked about law enforcement, adult protective services. Oh, do you want to talk about community care licensing?
Sure, please.
This is another one that's been frustrating. In my mom's case, my mom was taken from her home in June of 2010. I made my first report to community care licensing in July 7th, 2010. Now, let me put a little perspective here. When you're concerned about elder abuse, if you go to Department of Justice elder abuse websites, you're told, first of all, you report to law enforcement and adult protective services. Then if the person is in a long-term care facility, you go to the long-term care ombudsman, which we talked about was useless, and then community care licensing in California is the agency, the division of Department of Social Services that oversees, licenses, and enforces the regulations in these long-term care facilities, which are popularly known as assisted living, but the formal correct name is residential care facility for the elderly. So my mom is in one of these residential care facilities, and I believe that my mother's right to visitation is being violated because she's not being allowed to have visitors. So I called up community care licensing. I called them a bunch of times. I would say 20, 30 times easily, plus some emails, reporting that my mother was not allowed to have visitors. The person assigned to the case at that point in time was licensing program analyst Kathleen Wiggins Parker. And for quite some time, Ms. Wiggins Parker was not sure whether telling family that they would be arrested if they come on the property would really qualify as isolation or not. She wasn't sure if that constituted restricting visitation. The smart kids don't go to work for the government, do they? I guess I shouldn't say that on the air, but
what the heck?
Well, she had to go get guidance from Sacramento, so she wrote off to Sacramento and asked her legal department if not allowing someone in the front door and threatening to have them arrested was the same thing as restricting visitation. And about 3 months later, they came back and said, yes, that is restricting visitation. This resident's rights to visitation are being violated. So Ms. Wiggins Parker did finally issue a citation. September 27th, which is about 3 months after I started heckling the daylights out of her, she finally issued a citation for restricting my mom's right to visitation. That sounds like good news, right?
Yeah.
Well, 2 weeks later, October 8th, she cleared the citation because the facility had submitted a plan of correction to provide training to all of their staff. Now, they did not actually allow my mother to start having visitors. They kept doing the thing that got them the citation in the first place, but they got their citation cleared by agreeing that everyone would get an hour of training. That is the state of community care licensing, only it gets even better in Giselle's case. You know, we've been talking that person after person after person has tried to call Giselle, tried to visit Giselle. We are uniformly told to take a hike or worse. Well, I got involved in Giselle's case at the end of April. May 2nd, I started reporting to community care licensing the situation and the violation of her right to visitation. And I thought this was going to go pretty quickly because I had already been through the system. I have managed to get 6 citations issued against Wildwood because I've, over time, found the people in the department who are actually competent, all 1 or 2 of them, and developed some degree of rapport with them. So I was under the delusion that I would be able to do the same thing up here in Santa Clara County, 400 miles away, where I would find a few competent individuals, develop a relationship, and perhaps work together with them to improve care in the county. It didn't work that way. The investigation report came back saying, based on our investigation, visits and phone calls are permitted within the parameters established in the resident's file. Allegation is unfounded at this time, and no citation is being issued. So what are the parameters in the resident's file? Can I take the little old lady across the street, lock her up somewhere, put a note in her file that says no one's allowed in the front door, and that makes it all okay?
Well, that's what just is really killing me about this, Linda. You've shown them the proof, the documentation, in their own statutes, their own regulations, the things that govern their facility, the things that govern their office, the parameters they're supposed to be working within, and yet for some reason they don't have to.
Exactly.
I want to know why.
It seems that there's no oversight. You know, I don't want to condemn the entire division. Just yesterday I was on the phone with one of those few competent people in Southern California, community care licensing program analyst by the name of Allison Harris, who works out of the Riverside office. And I had submitted a number of complaints about the facility where my mom is, Wildwood Canyon Villa. And I will admit at this point, it's a fairly adversarial relationship, and anything that looks like it might be a violation, I report, and poor Allison has to go investigate it and give her opinion. And there were a number of things I had reported that were really kind of marginal, and Allison took the time to go through the regulation and read the regulation to me and discuss her understanding of what that regulation means and how she felt that the current situation with my mom could not be substantiated as a violation of that regulation. She wasn't saying that there wasn't a violation there, but given the information I had provided and the information she had been able to get through talking with other people, she could not substantiate that violation, and therefore she could not issue a citation. And I really appreciated her time and her candor and her having those discussions with me. You know, we may not see eye to eye on everything, and I certainly take a strong position where my mother's care is concerned, but I feel that Allison is following what she feels the regulations to be and the intent of those regulations. And she was very professional, very courteous, and we ended with my thanking her for the improvement she's made not only in my mother's living conditions, but everyone else at Wildwood, because as a result of her investigations over the past few months and the citation she has issued, I think everyone at Wildwood has a much better quality of life now. The facility is being brought much closer to what it should be. So there are some competent, professional, caring people, but unfortunately I have not yet found one in Santa Clara County in our community care licensing in Northern California.
You know, the thing, too, that keeps rolling across my mind here, how many times, just say in the last 5 years, have you seen news reports about some facility being busted for abusing its residents, for neglecting them, where they have found people in horrendous, horrendous conditions inside these facilities? And these are just the ones that escape and, you know what I'm saying, the stories that escape and actually get reported in mainstream media. I have contacted, Linda, some of the large radio stations here, a few of the TV stations, just trying to determine if they had any interest in this, would they consider this, and without exception, they basically all told me it wasn't news. And I said, well, if you were in one of those facilities and your assets were being looted, and you were probably and most likely being medicated against your will to keep you quiet and to render you dysfunctional, and if none of your kids or grandchildren or friends could come visit you or call you on the phone, would you think it was a story then?
You know, and or if it was your mom or your grandma, would you care
yeah.
then?
Yeah. Why is it, Linda, that these things have to land in people's laps in order for it to become important?
Well, I think Chris Murphy has made a very good point that cases like mine really are very unusual. In both situations, if someone is dissatisfied with the care in a facility, they move their parent, they take them out. You know, mm-hmm. I'm in the unpleasant situation of not having any say over what happens to my mom, just like Giselle's son is in the position of not having any say over what happens to his mother. You know, by virtue of these conservatorships, we can't do anything to help our moms. And so the normal response of a caring family of, this is a rotten facility, we don't like what's happening here, we're taking grandma and we're moving her someplace better. You know, that would happen with the caring families. With the families mm-hmm. that don't care, the person just wastes away because, well, they don't care. They put grandma in a warehouse and they pay the minimum they can until they can inherit the estate. But the caring families who are in there, who do go visit, who do keep an eye on things, will move their loved one to a better place, or they, just by virtue of being there, that resident will get better care because the family is there several times a week watching what happens. And so at least that resident that has visitors will get good care, or at least moderately good care. Mm-hmm. And Marcus and I and the other children of these victims are in the position of, we see it happening, we don't like it, we know it's wrong, we know our parents are being harmed, and there is nothing we can do about it.
That's got to be the most god-awful feeling. I don't think anything is any worse than someone else having control of your loved one, your parent, your child, whoever it is, and being that victim, and they are victims at this point, being at the mercy of someone who absolutely does not give a damn what happens to them, and knowing you can't do anything. And what really angers me here is they've set the law up to make sure you can't do anything. And this is just unthinkable. I say, this is torture. I don't care how you throw this up in the air and fluff it up. This is torture. This is a known torture practice. Why would we be doing it? Why would anybody do this to another human being? Why don't they just rob them like a regular thief? Why don't they just do it through normal channels and leave that person alone?
You know, I've said so many times, if my mother's conservator had simply stolen the estate but still allowed my mother to have a decent quality of life, I might not be fighting her. You know, if all she had stolen was the money,
yes,
I'd say, well, Anna, it wasn't my money anyway. It was my mom's money. And yes, I agree, it's wrong of her to steal the estate. It was not the way my mother wanted things to be, but still, it's just money. You don't turn your life upside down over just money. The reason I am so involved and keep fighting is because my mother was stolen. You know, she just wanted
her
money.
Her whole life was stolen.
Yeah, my mother was stolen. My life has been really pretty much gone down the drain. Families that go through this are devastated. They are emotionally and financially devastated. And I have not met anyone who's gone through this who has anything like a normal life afterward.
Well, and I hear that from so many of these people that have been involved in these cases, that not only was the victim's life stolen and destroyed, but so was the lives of the you know, family and the friends,
mm-hmm.
who saw what was happening and tried everything they knew, everything that they rationally thought could be done. And so many of them, Linda, go into it believing that, well, the law is on my side, so I can straighten this out, I can fix this. And to find out that here we have these judges who facilitate all of this, I think that's something I don't understand. How do these people sleep at night? I don't understand it. Why isn't there any sense of conscience? Why empathy, sympathy? There's nothing.
You know, we haven't even been able to get to the point of seeing what the judge will do. You know, I don't rant and rave about us having a corrupt judge, because I honestly don't know. We're not there yet. We have a judge who doesn't get things done, who stalls, kicks the can down the road. Personally, I think he's hoping my mother will die so he doesn't have to have a trial on the conservatorship, and that would save him some time and he could go play golf. But as to whether he will openly support, once we present the evidence in court, whether he will openly support the people who harmed my mother, I really don't know, because we're not to the point of even seeing what's going to happen yet. It's only been 2 years.
Oh, God.
I mean,
what
it'll be next
this?
February before we have our first trial. So that will be the first we really get an opportunity to put evidence before the court and see where it goes from there. And
well, I think between now and then, Linda, what we need to do is just keep pushing this out there, get as much media attention as we can, keep it in front of everybody's face, so that when this does go to court, they don't simply sweep it under the rug and walk away.
No, our case is incredibly strong. The documents that we've been getting through subpoenas and the testimonies we're getting under deposition have really been quite amazing, quite remarkable. You know, I had suspicions from day one on how things were choreographed, but things have come out in deposition that just blew me away.
Oh, my God. I just don't, and you have to hope and pray between now and then your mother doesn't pass away. You know,
well, I can't sue for elder abuse until she does.
Yeah, my God.
No, I expect to be in litigation for years to come. That's where my life is.
Okay, Linda, let me ask you this. You've tried everything else, God knows you have. Why can't we petition the state courts? I don't know if you would go to your state Supreme Court, and then I know you have just your regular state courts that has a head office, whatever you want to call it, but why can't we go to them and petition them to do something about these probate courts?
If you're talking about the state appellate court, we have to have a trial first to have something to appeal.
Well, no, I'm not talking about filing a lawsuit. What I'm talking about is notifying them of what is happening now. And you know, they damn well, they already know. They already know. But contacting them directly with your evidence and telling them, since they are the controllers, they're the ones that actually oversee these courts, they're the ones that appoint these jerks to be judges.
We have sent letters to the legislators. As far getting access to a judge is very difficult. I was trying to find some way to communicate with the judge, the presiding judge on Giselle's case. You know, since I know what it has taken to get into court for my mom, I was trying to find some quicker, easier way to get Giselle's case or some other local victims' cases into the court system without having to go through $200,000 of litigation to get there, because, frankly, they don't have the resources to do that. So I went down to the probate court, and actually some of this came on the advice of a San Jose police officer who told me that I am not to mention his name to anyone because he thinks he would be in trouble for giving advice on this case. But he said, go down to the probate court and just go talk to them about getting a court order for visitation. He says, yeah, we do this all the time with kids. You know, there's a complaint that one parent isn't letting the other parent visit the child. You just go down to family court. You get an order for visitation. It's all very quick, easy. There's a form that's already made out. You just fill in a few blanks. You take it to the judge. He stamps it. You're good to go. You show up with the court order. You get an officer for a civil standby, and it's all very simple. You have this done in a few days. It doesn't cost very much. And there's a system set up to expedite this. So if a dad or a mom is restricting a child from seeing the other parent, it's pretty easy to address that. He said, you know, we handle this all the time. Just go down to the court and they'll help you with it. Well, family court does not deal with adults. They deal with visitation with children. They sent me over to probate court, which is where Giselle's case is. So I go into probate court and talk to a clerk about how do we petition for an order for visitation? And she looks at me like I'm crazy. What are you talking about? She says she has never heard of anything like this before, and so I carefully explain to her that there is an older person who is not being allowed visitation. And I want to make use of this mechanism that the court has where a person can petition for visitation. And she disappeared for a fairly long period of time, and I went to talk to other people and came back and explained to me that, well, yes, the family court does have this mechanism of petitioning for visitation. Probate does not have anything similar. So she gave me that standardized form that family court uses for visitation. Says, but you can't use this in probate. What you're going to have to do is type this up on pleading paper using proper legal format, legal terminology, and submit a motion, and it will be calendared, and then that motion will be heard by the judge. And that is how you go about communicating with the judge in a probate case.
Really?
Really.
Oh,
so, you know, if you have a few $100,000 and a few years, you can probably pull this off. You know, that is how we got in to see my mom. We got an attorney. He submitted a petition for us to visit. What he actually submitted was a request for a restraining order against isolation. Since there wasn't an equivalent to a visitation order as you would get for a child, our attorney got a restraining order against isolating my mom. There was a court order that her conservator and the facility and their agents are restrained from isolating her. And it's worked. I can go see my mom. I can walk in the front door. Anybody who wants to go see my mom can go see her now. It only took 15 months and $70,000.
Gee, Merry Christmas.
So, you know, the concept is there, but it's not really worked out for using for older people.
Okay. I've got a couple more emails here that are basically saying the same thing or asking the same questions of why I am focusing an entire show on this when this is such a small problem. Apparently, they think it's only occurring there in your case, Linda. For Mary,
Alabama. No. I'm focusing on these two cases that I know very closely because I'm involved with them. If they go to NASGA, National Association to Stop Guardian Abuse, they can find many, many more cases across the country.
And support if they need it, yes.
Yes, I'm hoping to use my mom's case and Giselle's case as essentially the poster ladies for this issue because I have documents, I have interviews, I have mountains of information about these two cases. I do not want anyone to think that these are isolated cases.
No, and this is happening, and this is to Marion, Alabama, this is happening in every state of the union. It's happening on a daily basis to thousands of people, and just check your own state for cases on guardianship abuse there in Alabama. I'm sure you can pull things up. Go to NASGA, the National Association to Stop Guardian Abuse. Go to their website. There is so much information there. And as I said, there's a lot of support there. This is not an isolated thing. This is not a small problem. This is a rampant epidemic across the country. It has resulted in the theft of massive amounts of money and property while these people are held prisoner. And they basically are prisoners. They cannot get up and leave. They are, like in Linda's case, with her mother, they are prevented from having visitors, any contact with anyone outside the facility. This is happening in a neighborhood near you. And so you just need to do a little research and look this up. We've done several programs on this. You can check our archive here on Blog Talk. We have many, many shows racked up on this from all over the country. So please don't think this is an isolated event or just one small, minuscule little problem that's happening in California. This is massive. I have another email here, Linda, that says that basically if you were not allowed to see your mother, then you must have, and you're not the guardian, you must have been because you were incompetent. First off, let me say nothing could be further from the truth. But I had a gentleman, an article I put up for him called Injustice in the Golden State, and his name was Dr. Clark. This man's credentials rocked my world. 4-time U.S. ambassador. He had worked for NASA. He had been with the Air Force. This man had credentials that were absolutely incredible. His sister was put under a conservatorship. He was the trustee of her estate. They tried to declare him incompetent. This man has taught international law. Tried to declare him incompetent to handle his sister's estate. He won his case, and he is suing for attorney fees for what it cost him to defend his sister and himself from being declared incompetent to handle her case. This can happen to anyone. It doesn't make any difference who you are, and the bigger the estate, the greater the chances it's going to happen to you. And this, I'm always surprised, Linda, when I get communications from people, either by phone or email or however, that somehow they think this is just some little spot problem, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. That just shocks me because this is so widespread.
Well,
it's everywhere you go.
I've just recently been exposed to this same issue affecting dependent adults. You know, I came into this issue because it happened to my mom. I connected with other people who were advocating for their moms or their dads or their aunts. Usually it's the mom. And, you know, I say, you know, it's about your mom because I'd say 9 out of 10 cases are about the mom. But just these past few weeks, I've been introduced to people who are the parents of disabled younger people. Parents of disabled children. One man I met last week is the father of an autistic son. The other man is the parent of a son with Down syndrome, and he's going to be your guest on Sunday. And, you know, again, I was asking, what's the motivation? You know, with my mom, I understood that it was about her estate. She had a large estate. It was all in cash. She had dementia, didn't know what was happening. She was just such a perfect target. It was so easy with my mom. with Giselle, not a huge amount of cash, but a home in Santa Clara County, Silicon Valley, a home that was paid for. That's a fair amount of money any way you look at it. Most of these people have some assets. So I was talking to Dr. Bob, who's going to be on Sunday, and say, well, you know, your son is disabled. What's the attraction in him? Why do the guardians want your son so badly? And Dr. Bob explained to me that a disabled person receives in excess of $100,000 a year from the federal government in funding because of that disability. And it clicked.
Yep.
You know, his son is not this destitute person with no job and no assets and no means. His son is a person who receives over $100,000 a year, and he will continue to for the rest of his life. He is very attractive to a guardian.
Well, and in those GAO reports, too, they pointed this out, that the Medicare-Medicaid fraud associated with vulnerable adults and the elderly approaches $5.4 billion, that's with a B, dollars per year.
Oh, I haven't even got into that. Yes, that could be a show all by itself. Medicare fraud for my mom is about $5,000 a month and has been for since October 2010. And that's what I know about. And as we, as our, as NASGA releases some more information, we might want to do a show on Medicare fraud around hospice. That's, without getting into a lot of the nitty-gritty, Medicare pays for hospice. And once a person goes on hospice, Medicare puts in about $5,000 a month that then goes to a hospice agency to provide hospice services. And in some cases, hospice does wonderful things. There are people who truly benefit from the care in hospice. There are other situations, my mother's included, where hospice is not appropriate. If the paperwork were straightened out, she would not qualify for hospice, but documents have been altered, concocted to make it appear that she qualifies. And it, again, we can do just a sniff test of, you know, does this seem right? I think most listeners will understand that hospice is supposed to be about end-of-life care. And if you go into the Medicare regulations, in order to be covered by Medicare, the person has to be certified as having a terminal illness and being expected to live less than 6 months. My mother's been on hospice since 2010.
And that's, you know, that's something I'm trying to figure out. And I remember when hospice did operate basically as a volunteer service. I know in my own brother's death back in 2001, the last 3 months of his life, we had hospice workers who came and sat with him, visited with him, so we could get a break and you know, and get some time off and come back refreshed and so on. But this is basically what they did. They also made sure that transportation, if he needed it for the doctor, whatever, was provided, that everything, and this was a valuable service. But I want to know when, Linda, they became part of this predator class. When did this change, and how did it change?
I think all we need to look at is when the demographic of the population moved to where we had this bulge of older people with money. You know, if we go back 20 years when the bulge in the population was fairly young and active and in their prime years, I would suspect we didn't have so much of this going on. It may have been here and there, but I think this became a growth industry when, you know, I look around my neighborhood, and I have three very close neighbors who are prime candidates in their 80s or 90s, Silicon Valley homes in a nice neighborhood, completely paid for, I assume assets in the bank. These people are fantastic targets. They're just perfect, and it would be, knowing what I know, it would be so easy to do. And I think this became a growth industry when we had that bulge in the population of these older people like my mom, like Giselle, like my neighbors, who own their homes, have money in the bank, and are somewhat vulnerable. You know, that's who the criminals go after. It's who is vulnerable at the moment. And right now, who's vulnerable is the older ladies who own their homes, and that's what's being targeted.
Well, and there is an inordinate number of women that this seems to be done to. Linda, again, who does this? What kind of person does this? And then to make a living doing it.
Well, VITAS Hospice Services is owned by Roto-Rooter.
What?
Yes. They'll clean your drains and then clean out your estate.
Yeah. And then clean your wallet.
Yes. VITAS Hospice, which is my mother's hospice provider, these are franchises, and they are owned by Roto-Rooter. Gives you a real warm, fuzzy feeling.
These
are franchises. They're like 7-Eleven. This is a 7-Eleven of hospice services.
Oh, you're kidding. Hospice is a franchise?
My mother's hospice provider is a franchise.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, VITAS has franchises all over the country. I could be misspeaking. I have not investigated them to any huge degree. That's information that's been provided by an associate who's looked into them. So I should disclose that I have not personally investigated the company myself, as I have a lot of these other issues. But this information is from another advocate who is generally quite thorough in his research.
Oh, geez. I wanted to move on here to something else. You talked about contacting State Senator Joe Simitian in the 11th District.
Oh, yeah.
And you say here that the online locator indicates Villa Fontana is in Senator Simitian's district, and he claims to be this big champion of senior issues and authored the 2005 Financial Elder Abuse Reporting Act. And he go on to say down here that you contacted his office. You had been since early May, getting no response, and then yesterday you sent an email. He wrote back, Tyler Haskell did on his behalf, says the online mapping utility is wrong and Villa Fontana is not in Senator Simitian's district. They will not be getting involved, and that's that.
And that's,
so is
that.
It,
that is, that's how he ended the phone call, and it's on my voicemail, and if I get myself together, I'll make an MP3 of it so people can hear it. Yeah, he actually ended with, and that's that.
Oh, yeah,
thank you so much.
And you say he's the Senator Simitian is termed out of the Senate, and he will join the Santa Clara County Board of Supervisors in 2013. This is the same Board of Supervisors that's supposed to be overseeing all this stuff?
You got it.
Oh,
yes.
For God's
yes.
sake.
So even if Giselle is not in his Senate district right now, you would think he might be concerned because he will be representing her as her supervisor come next year. You know, California has put term limits on a lot of our offices, and this was supposed to be a good idea to keep these people from being lifers in the same office forever. Only what has happened instead is they just churn around and go from one seat to another, to another, to another. So,
yes. Well, when he takes his seat on the Board of Supervisors, we'll be there to greet him. And
he certainly can't say he doesn't know about it. He's been informed.
Right. Okay. That you went on and you talked about, I want to get to this because we've only got about 5-6 minutes left here. You talked about this Assemblyman Jim Beal in the 24th District. He represents Gisella's district. He's also the chair on the Assembly Committee on Human Services. My. He says oversees adult protective services and community care licensing. He's not doing his job. It says in cases where the public guardian is appointed as the conservator, The Board of Supervisors has oversight to make changes, and although we do not directly investigate cases due to confidentiality, we can facilitate this process a number of ways. I am more than happy to assist Ms. Riordan's family in this process, but they need to personally contact me directly. If they do not reside on District 24, I will contact the appropriate assembly office.
I would like to hold him to this. In essence, I think he's saying that he's not going to respond to me as an advocate because I'm not a family member of one of the victims. He wants to hear from the victims themselves. And I would respond that he has been hearing from the victims themselves for a very long time, and perhaps I wrote a letter that was a little bit more strongly worded than some of the other letters he received. But for whatever reason, he did actually respond to my letter, or, well, his assistant Sunshine did. But he is asking, Senator Beal, Assemblymember Beal, is asking for the family members of victims to contact him directly. And I would strongly encourage these family members to contact him, to be in touch with each other, to coordinate our actions together, and hold him to the fire. He said he wants to help. Well, let's give him every opportunity to help, and let's make sure it happens publicly.
There you go. And something else, I've had people say, well, you know, will you call so-and-so for me? But be nice. No, the time for being nice is over. Being nice, and I've heard people talking to these, like congressmen or supervisors, and they're yes, sir, and a no, ma'am, and skip all that crap. These people, respect is earned, and these people have not earned your respect. Don't treat them in a respectful manner, and I stand by that. Treat them the way they act. They act like jerks. Treat them like the jerks they are, and quit being so darn nice. That's my advice. Quit being so nice. Confront them. These people
confront them. Yeah, we do need to be civil. We need to behave in a manner that is appropriate in public. Because if we don't, we will be arrested. Well, at best, we'll be considered crazies. I went to grad school at Berkeley. I was not there in the heyday of the protests, but I certainly know people who took part in protests and got arrested. So, you know, a certain amount of decorum in a public situation is appropriate. The public will be watching. The press may be watching. We need to not appear to be crazy. That said,
well, I don't think I'm crazy, Linda.
No,
but
we need to express, you know, well, just simply yelling and screaming that they're evil and horrible. And,
well, I wasn't talking about that. What I'm talking about is confronting people and speaking to them in a confrontational tone. Get their attention.
Yeah, you show up with a short list of bullet points that are completely relevant to your case and are supported with laws and regulations, and you stick to your talking points and don't let them drag you away from it.
Exactly. I watched that video you sent of the town hall meeting you attended. It was a meeting of that type. It was a meeting of this Board of Supervisors.
And they're just sort of glazed and staring at the wall.
Yes, exactly. I was watching their faces after you spoke, and I saw two of them turn red and put their heads down.
Really?
And, yeah. I
didn't know. You know, when I'm speaking, I'm very focused on, well, I'm focused on my bullet points and getting through what I want to say in the whole 60 seconds they allow me to say it. So when I'm speaking, I'm very focused on my immediate surroundings, and I don't really get to watch them. If they are embarrassed and ashamed, I think that's wonderful. Perhaps they are human.
They should be. We've got about a minute and a half left here, Linda. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on this evening. And again, I apologize to everyone for Sunday evening. There was nothing I could do about it. Like I say, vast portions of the net went down across the country, and nobody has given any explanation at all as to why that happened and why all the DNS servers went down. It didn't happen to everybody, but as near as we can tell, it happened to about 50% of the ISP providers. And Linda, you and I both went down at the same time. And both of you have been hit with the virus. And here you are on the West Coast, and I'm in, you know, the heartland here. But like I say, I heard from the folks at Red State Talk Radio. They were offline for 6 hours, couldn't get anywhere, couldn't get a page up, couldn't do anything. So I have no idea what that was about, and I do apologize. But we will be back next Sunday evening, and I believe we will have Robert Fettgather with us.
Yes, Dr. Bob is the father of a disabled child, and he has some amazing stories to tell himself.
Okay, we will be back then, and God forbid anything happens to the net again. But thanks, everybody, for tuning in this evening. Linda, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I know how busy you are with all of this.
Marty, and thank you for everything you're doing, making it public.
Well, we're trying. And like I said, Linda is going to be, as much as she's able to, co-hosting these shows with me, because she knows far more about this than I do. And so she'll be back with us Sunday night. Again, thanks, everybody. And we'll be back next week. Good night.
Good night.